everyone, and thanks for joining me again. I'm very excited about today's episode, in which we get to dive into the psychiatric relationship between Marilyn Monroe and Dr. Greenson with a true professional. Before we get started, I'd like to make a quick note. I am currently in Poughkeepsie, New York, visiting my baby niece, Charlie, for the first time. And so I'm recording this from under a blanket in her nursery with my remote recording equipment. And it's raining outside, and it feels a little bit like I'm in a pillow fort. So if this interview sounds different at all, that's probably why. And thank you for understanding in advance if you notice any oddities in my vocals today. Okay, so today we're speaking with Dr. Arthur B. Markman, PhD, from the entertaining and insightful psychology podcast, Two Guys on Your Head. Two Guys on Your Head is an 8-minute discussion of how research in psychology applies to our daily lives. And it's awesome, for the record. Art is a professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Texas in Austin and extremely knowledgeable about psychology, therapeutic practices, and the way our brains work. Hi, Art. Thank you for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much.
The relationship between psychiatrist and patient is a really interesting one. It's intimate, but professional. How would you describe it?
So when people enter into a therapeutic relationship with someone, whether it's an MD or a counselor, what you're getting is a requirement to divulge a tremendous amount about yourself in order for that therapeutic relationship to move forward, what is traditionally called disclosure. And the thing about disclosure of any sort is that it requires a tremendous amount of trust. After all, think about going to the supermarket and having the supermarket checkout person just ask you, so what are you going to do for the rest of the day? Even that question feels invasive because you think to yourself, what in the world does this person need to know that bit of information in order to do their job? But when you come to a therapeutic relationship, you actually need to be able to open up things that you may not talk to with any other person on planet Earth. And consequently, it is a very special relationship and one that a therapist can exploit to their own ends should they choose to, which is why there are such strong ethical guidelines around those relationships.
Right. I assume then that professional ethics are a staple of psychiatric and psychological schooling.
That's correct. And so regardless of what area of psychology you're in, there's a tremendous amount of discussion of ethics. And this includes both the therapeutic side and also the research side, because, of course, doing research on people's psychology can also lead to potential ethical violations. And so the entire field has a whole infrastructure and a set of concepts for trying to help people to understand how to behave ethically.
That makes sense. And I'm so glad to hear it. So Art, what is transference and what is countertransference?
So in the concept of transference initially emerged out of Freudian approaches to psychotherapy. And it's important in the context of the work that you're doing to understand that the way that the field of psychology acts and operates now is, of course, quite different from the way that it did 50 or 60 years ago. But one of the things that is important to bear in mind is, and it's, I think, true in many therapeutic relationships even now, is that whenever you develop a close relationship with somebody, you may come to have feelings about that person that relate to other significant others in your life that remind you of that person. And in a therapeutic relationship, that can often involve feelings that you had towards someone in your life that is also the center of the discussion in the therapeutic relationship. And so you may come to see your therapist in a way and to transfer some of your feelings to that therapist that you would have for a parent or someone else who's part of that that therapeutic discussion. That's the notion of transference. Then countertransference is how it is how things can operate in the other direction and where some of the potential ethical problems can come in, which is that a therapist may then end up with feelings towards their patients. You can sometimes see a therapist having feelings towards their patients that mirror that relationship.
I see. I can also see how that would be fraught for professional guidelines being blurred and the therapeutic practice being compromised.
Yes. And of course, it's a natural thing for people to want to have an emotional relationship with the people that they're close to. So it's hard to keep that separate. And in fact, it's not that therapists are encouraged to try to keep their emotions out of it. It's to recognize the influence that their emotions can have on the nature of that relationship and to ensure that it remains strictly professional.
Absolutely. So I would love to get your professional feedback about the therapeutic relationship between Dr. Ralph Greenson and his patient, Marilyn Monroe. For background, in case this is relevant to your insights, Marilyn Monroe had a schizophrenic mother and absent father. She lived briefly in an orphanage and with several foster families and family friends until she entered adulthood. Throughout life, she made occasional references to inappropriate contact inflicted upon her during her childhood, but this was never substantiated. When she met Dr. Greenson, she had been undergoing psychoanalysis for years. She had attempted to commit suicide 4 times and been committed to a hospital once. She suffered from anxiety, insomnia, and was deeply reliant on barbiturates. So that's her background. Dr. Greenson was a Freudian and developed an unusual treatment method that included several aspects I find questionable. So I'd love to get your opinions. Do you have any thoughts before we start taking these one by one?
Yeah, the one big thing, the one overarching thing I want to make sure that we get out up front is that a core ethical principle for psychotherapists is what's called the dual relationship principle, which is the idea that if you engage in a therapeutic relationship with a client, that you are barred from having any other relationship with that client. That means you can't be their friend, you can't be their coworker, you can't be their family member, you can't be sexually involved with them in any way. And the idea is that the therapeutic relationship has so much emotion in it, it has so much closeness in it, it involves so much disclosure that there is an immediate opportunity for abusing the emotions and the information that you have if you develop some other relationship, and the tensions of those other relationships can actually lead people to do things in the therapeutic relationship that aren't in the best interest of the client or patient.
Wow. Thank you for laying that out, because I feel like you just set the foundation for the majority of today's discussion.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that principle may have been called into question more than once, more than 2 or 3 times.
Yeah, exactly.
So the first thing I want to talk about is this role I call the good father. Dr. Greenson believed that Marilyn suffered from the lack of a home life. She'd never had a stable family home. To address this, he recreated the experience for her by inviting her into his own family. He encouraged her to develop relationships with his children, going for walks on the beach, attending their parties with their friends, having talks with them. Before a typical evening session at his home, it was common for Marilyn to arrive with champagne, spend time with Greenson's children, usually his daughter, go into session with Dr. Greenson, come out and dine with the family, then help clean up and wash dishes, and then stay late into the evening sipping champagne and socializing with the family. So this was his attempt to ingratiate her into a stable family life. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so there are sort of two sides to this coin. On the one hand, because of the dual relationship principle that I was talking about, this is it's the way he went about trying to help her to have a feeling of stability and a feeling of a family life was really ethically fraught. So on the one hand, I think the diagnosing the idea that having a more stable sense of family would be beneficial is likely to be quite positive. But there are several ways that one could go about trying to suggest that. So you could help your patient to find people to stabilize the social environment and to create that sense of family. By inviting her into his family, however, he was immediately creating a violation of this dual relationship principle and really putting tension on the therapeutic relationship, because now, of course, she now has these dual allegiances. She has both. She now views her doctor as both her therapeutic partner, but also person who is a family member, which now creates a feeling of obligations within the family that now I think both take away from that relationship, that therapeutic relationship, but also create a sense in which I now know that this person knows so much about me that I feel obligated in that family situation to do things I might not do even with my normal family members.
Yes, that makes sense. And so inner conflict can really take hold. The next thing I want to talk about is sexual fulfillment. Marilyn credited Dr. Greenson with teaching her how to reach sexual climax. Was this problematic if he was actively also assuming a role as her father?
Yeah. Well, obviously, there are so many relationship boundaries that are being crossed here that this is a network of problems. So obviously, maybe not obviously for listeners, but getting help with sexual dysfunction is something that can be an important therapeutic that can be important therapeutically, right? So it's not that someone seeking help for sexual fulfillment is necessarily a problem. However, when placed into the context of also putting someone in within their family structure, now you are blending several different kinds of relationships. So first of all, it's not clear what the relationship is between the other issues that were being treated and the sexual issues. On top of that, by bringing Marilyn into his family, Dr. Greenson is actually now creating a violation of other boundaries, because generally speaking, the parental relationship is not one that we expect to also have a sexual component to it. Now, I should say that a lot of this also involves putting a more modern lens on the way that we think about these relationships. For Freudians, there was a much deeper set of beliefs about the relationship between family relationships and sexuality than we accept today in modern practice. But that's so some of this involves we have to recognize that some of what we're doing is placing a modern sensibility on something that happened in the past. Still, putting all of these relationships into a single mixing bowl just seems like something that is bound to cause problems.
And I can't help but think problems were caused. Hi, guys. There are a few things we all like. Vacations, indulgences, and smelling good. You know when someone makes that effort to apply a really delicious scent to themselves. And nothing makes me feel better than when I give someone a hug and they say, "Oh, you smell great." Why does that feel so good? I don't know, but it does. Scentbird is a luxury perfume subscription service that keeps me smelling good month after month. I like wearing perfume, especially when I put effort into my hair and outfit and makeup. The experience just isn't complete unless I dab a beautiful scent on myself. Scentbird has 450 designer brands, and you can choose any one you want every month. They'll send you a 30-day supply, which is 120 sprays, so you will always smell amazing. I went on Scentbird and wanted to choose a few to experiment. I became enchanted with the names of these inventive perfumes that I just needed to smell and figure out what they smelled like. I chose English Laundry, Juliet Has a Gun, Lady Vengeance, Confessions of a Rebel, About Last Night. I mean, I just had to know what these all smelled like, wouldn't you? But I also ordered Stella by Stella McCartney because I'm just such a sucker for that broad. Anyway, getting to explore all these scents has been so much fun and a total adventure. No department stores, no pushy salespeople, no dabbing testers, and hey, free shipping. Plus, this whole service is so affordable, it's crazy. That's why I always use scentbird.com. With my exclusive offer, you'll get 50% off your first month today, which is, get this, it's only $7.50 for your first perfume. Go to scentbird.com, that's S-C-E-N-T, bird.com/deliberations, and use my code deliberations for 50% off your first month. Scentbird, scentbird.com/deliberations. Sign on and smell amazing. The next thing I want to talk about, you spoke to already briefly when you explained the dual relationship principle, and that is Dr. Greenson's role as career liaison. Dr. Greenson became a liaison between Marilyn and her studio, 20th Century Fox, many times. The week she was fired, Greenson tried salvaging her job by insisting he could make Marilyn do, quote, anything reasonable he wanted. Was his role as a career liaison at odds with that of therapist?
Yeah. Well, so this is one of those great examples of why the dual relationship principle is in place. Because if you act as someone's agent, which is a particular kind of business relationship, then there are particular things that you're trying to accomplish. On the one hand, agents work on behalf of their clients to try to get good deals. But on the other hand, agents also serve as a mediator between their client and the people who are going to hire them. And so in this case, you're seeing this example of a studio saying, well, there's particular behavior that's problematic, and we would like to see that changed. And Dr. Greenson saying, oh, yeah, I can make that happen as well, which is at odds with the therapeutic relationship. So what you're seeing is a great example of why the dual relationship principle is in place in the first place, because you don't want to have someone who is supposed to be in the role of healing you and also in the role of exploiting your behavior in order to create business success.
Right. And as someone on her payroll, he was probably also motivated to ensure her business success. So, conflict of interest there. The next thing I want to ask you about is that of prescription. Some believe that Dr. Greenson kept Marilyn reliant on him by prescribing her an excessive amount of barbiturates. This is not a contention I'm making, because I don't understand their history of prescription. I don't know how much he prescribed her, how often, or his thought process behind it. I don't have enough information to make that assertion. However, I did want to ask you, what are some difficulties when it comes to prescribing drugs to someone who is an understood addict?
Well, I think that what we have to think about is, generally speaking, the relationship between drugs and therapy, which is an issue that continues on to the present day, and this is they really need to be done in concert. We know now drugs, for example, if we think about antidepressant drugs, that antidepressant drugs alone are not an effective treatment. And for people experiencing significant signs of depression, often just therapy that in the absence of drugs is not sufficient either, but that a combination of the two, when done well and monitored carefully, can be much more effective than either alone. So certainly the issue is not that a therapist should be avoiding drugs at all costs, because that can be a real benefit. Now the question, and by the way, our beliefs about which drugs are going to be most effective have changed over time. This is part of the way that medicine works, is that we learn about drug regimes and what is most effective. So to me, what stands out as being most problematic is simply the number of different fronts along which Dr. Greenson was trying to provide to cover every aspect of Marilyn Monroe's life. So, what I would say is it would be great if other people were brought into the process here. Even if he was prescribing barbiturates with the best possible intentions, there are so many other things going on that having someone independent to step in and approve that treatment would be a benefit, in the same way that anyone who's suffering from a significant disease often has a team of physicians working with them in order to make sure that they're covering all their bases. So I think here, the issue has much more to do with the fact that a single individual was taking command of just too large a swath of treatment.
Right. And in fairness, I do know Marilyn's general practitioner was also prescribing her barbiturates, so he wasn't the only one, but there was not successful coordination or communication between the two about what, when, and how much they were prescribing her.
Right. Yeah. And that's what's important, is that a medical team needs to be working together with the patient. And this is something that even in the present day is a challenge. And one of the reasons why there's so much work around electronic medical records and coordination is in the hope that patients of all types are getting treatment that that is being monitored by all of the different medical professionals that they're working with.
Right. Absolutely. So the next point I want to talk to you about is, in my mind, the most controversial, and I'm calling this talking point spy. Ralph Greenson arranged for a friend of his to be Marilyn Monroe's housekeeper. He then asked her to report back to him about her movements and actions and behaviors. He ostensibly wanted to keep an eye on her for her own safety. What are your thoughts on this?
So, one of the things about ethics in psychology broadly, and this is true not just in thinking about therapy, it's also true in thinking about research, is that we are duty-bound to minimize the amount of deception that we engage in. So it is sometimes necessary, for example, in research practice, to deceive participants about the point of a study, because if they understood the full purpose, they might not act in a way that was natural for them. But in those cases, it is also critical, and you can't get studies approved without stating when you will remove the deception, when you will actually let someone know exactly what has happened. And under no circumstances can you choose to deceive someone and never let them know that they were deceived. And that's important partly because of the potential for abuse that comes with deception, and partly because of the trusted relationship that's required between therapists and patients, between researchers and participants. And you undermine that trust when there is deception. So to install someone as a spy and to create a ruse and a deception and then never to uncover that is simply something that flies in the face of the kinds of ethical principles that we ask psychologists to abide by.
Which I'm so grateful exist and are more commonly enforced today. Dr. Greenson described Marilyn as a, quote, borderline paranoid addictive personality. And I know these diagnoses and terms evolve with time, so this diagnosis might be outdated today. But interestingly, the year before his death, Greenson wrote an essay entitled Special Problems in Psychotherapy with the Rich and Famous in 1976, in which he wrote about Marilyn's case. And he said, quote, rich and famous people need the therapist 24 hours a day, and they are insatiable. These patients are seductive. Do you have any thoughts on this diagnosis and or this near final word of his?
Well, I think one of the difficulties for Dr. Greenson trying to diagnose a patient under these circumstances is that by controlling so many aspects of her life, by having a therapeutic relationship, also integrating her into his family, also having elements that touched on her sex life, also also engaging in elements of business practice with her, it is very difficult for him to have an objective sense of how much she needed a particular therapist. Now, it's clear that a person two things are clear. I mean, one is it seems clear that Marilyn Monroe had a number of psychological issues that did need to be addressed. And it's also clear she led a very complex life, as many people who are in entertainment do, where they need other professionals to assist them with parts of their lives, like having a good agent to negotiate with the studio. So yes, I think it's very true that Marilyn probably needed both good medical care, good therapeutic care, and good business practice, and probably would have benefited from a stable home life. But it is by no means clear that a single individual should have provided all of that. In fact, a single individual should clearly not have provided all of it. And so in some ways, you know, you can read this essay as being a little self-serving. I think when somebody looks back on their lives and sees something that could be viewed as a significant failure. So if you were the primary therapist to a very famous person who very publicly committed suicide, you might think, well, this would be viewed as a significant life failure. And so as you reach the end of your life, finding a way to remove some sting of that failure is something I think you can understand why someone would want to do. But I do think that in this case, you know, in a more modern environment, Marilyn Monroe might have benefited from having a much clearer separation of roles for the various for these various issues. Not that would have necessarily led to a different outcome. Unfortunately, despite the best care that the field of psychology and psychiatry provides to patients, there are still negative outcomes that happen. So it's we can't say, oh, this would have led to a better outcome, but it certainly would have led to a more ethical practice.
Yes, and I think we can say it wouldn't have led to a worse outcome. You know, I can't help but think that Marilyn would have stood a better chance receiving psychiatric care today, with more research and understanding behind us, and more safeguards in place for ethical professional practice.
Yeah, absolutely.
Art, thank you so much. Are there any other thoughts or ideas about Marilyn Greenson, or any of the topics we've explored today that you'd like to add?
You know, the only thing I would say is I think that there are two values to people thinking through stories like this. One is that I think most people are endlessly fascinated by minds that work well and minds that don't. And so it can sometimes just be fascinating to think about cases like this. But I also think it's important for people to bear in mind that this dual relationship principle is actually powerful throughout our lives, that we should always recognize that when we have multiple relationships with anyone, that it creates a certain amount of tension. And even though it may not be unethical in many cases, so for example, there are many cases in which people work with members of their family, and that's not unethical per se, we should recognize it creates tension. and understand that tension, because that's, you know, one of the benefits of a story like this is that it can teach us something about our own lives. And this is one of these cases where I think people can learn a little bit about their own social environment by hearing something about a famous case.
Absolutely. Thank you for saying that. I certainly hope so. And you mentioned it briefly when you spoke to our fascination with the way minds work well and not so well. Your podcast is fascinating, informative, and very easily digestible. Could you please tell us more about Two Guys on Your Head and how people can find your podcast and listen?
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks so much for giving me the chance to do that. Two Guys on Your Head is just a short podcast that we do weekly. It's about 8 minutes long. It is actually produced by KUT, which is a local NPR station in Austin, Texas. It is my partner in crime on this show is a guy by the name of Bob Duke, who is also a psychologist. And the two of us have just free-floating conversations that we hope are both entertaining and educational, where we pick apart findings from the research literature, sometimes brand new findings, sometimes things that people may not know about but that are older, but with an eye towards also applying that to the daily lives that people live. Because one of the things we always say is that almost everybody we know has a mind, and almost nobody knows how that mind works. And we think people would benefit a lot from knowing a little bit more about the way they think, act, feel, and interact with other people. And you can find Two Guys on Your Head pretty much wherever podcasts are found, iTunes, Stitcher, NPR One, and any other place where you can find a podcast, you're likely to find us.
It's a great show. I love listening to it, and I think it's amazing how you're able to squeeze so much informative entertainment into these easily digestible 8-minute windows. And I really feel like I'm actively learning and expanding my understanding of our minds and psychology in general. So thank you. Guys, definitely check out Two Guys on Your Head. And Art, thank you again for your thoughtful input. I've had feelings already about the controversial aspects of this therapeutic relationship, but I feel very gratified to hear it broken down by a professional who can deconstruct and explain what I felt deep down was objectionable. So thank you. Thank you for that sincerely.
Oh, my pleasure.
I look forward to continuing to learn about how our brains work from Two Guys on Your Head. And I'm so happy you could join us today, Art.
Well, thanks so much, Chelsea. It was really great talking with you.
Thanks for listening, guys. On Wednesday, the jury in the Stowe trial delivers a verdict. See you then.